May it please the Court, this is an appeal, unfortunately for the second time in this case, dealing with the issues of the extension of the statute of limitations pursuant to 18 Del Code Section 6856. There really, I believe, present two basic arguments. One, did the providing of the notice by Federal Express, where there's a signed receipt, provide the same purpose of the statute and fulfill the purpose of the statute as to showing proof that the notice was actually received? As Judge Tolliver said when he decided the case below, he himself said the purpose of the statute was met by sending Federal Express. But since it was, the statute says certified mail, he granted the motion to dismiss. That's the first issue, which I'll get to in a minute. The second issue is, how strictly do you enforce the statute of limitations contained in that statute? The defendant's basic argument is that the statute of limitations has to be fairly strictly enforced. But in making that argument, I believe the defendants ignore the fact that the legislature has spoken on that issue when it amended the statute in 2003. When it amended the statute, prior to this, the cases the defendants rely on are cases going back into the 1980s and 1990s, which the Court is fully familiar with, says when the legislature first in the 70s or 80s amended the statute, they wanted a strict statute of limitations. But then in 2003, the legislature spoke again and added a new provision which allowed an extension of the statute of limitations for 90 days. And the language in the statute is it will toll the statute of limitations.
Mr. Rager, the synopsis said, The Delaware cases that have been cited to us. The Delaware cases that have been cited to us appear uniformly to support the reasoning and the result reached by Judge Tolliver.
I'm not sure which.
Are there any Delaware cases to the contrary?
On which point, Your Honor? I'm sorry. As to whether or not they strictly enforce the statute of limitations? No, because this is, I believe, the first time this provision has ever been examined by any court, this new provision.
This 90-day tolling provision. The 90-day tolling provision.
Yes, that has never been examined before.
Is it fair to say that for your position you rely essentially on cases decided by courts outside of Delaware?
What I did is, obviously when this issue arose, I did as thorough a search I could to find any case that ever examined the issue of notice where it's required, where a statute requires
notice. Is it fair to say that for your position you rely on cases decided outside
of
Delaware?
Yes, there are no Delaware cases. But I do say those cases are uniform, and the defendants have been unable to cite any case that disagree with the position that all those cases take. But as I got started to say, when the legislature amended 6856, it set in a provision that provided for tolling of the statute of limitations. And if you look at the synopsis of the statute, it says the purpose of this is to grant a little more leeway or leniency in the observance of the statute of limitations.
But you agree the issue is statutory construction?
I would say yes.
So we don't get to intent or purpose unless there's an ambiguity, do we?
No, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. The law of this state is that where the legislature passed a law that somehow is remedial to ameliorate the statute of limitations, then it must be viewed expansively.
All right. Well, help me by thinking about two other statutes. One statute, 18 Delaware Code 1716D, says mail by certified mail, return receipt requested, or by overnight delivery using a nationally recognized carrier, close quote. So there we have a Delaware statute that specifically contemplates something like Federal Express. Then we have another statute, 26 Del C 203 capital CE1, that says certified mail or its equivalent. So we have three statutes, the one you're arguing about and the two I've just quoted. How do we get beyond the fact that the legislature knows how to write the statute differently and specifically did it in two other instances that would provide you the relief you're requesting and yet didn't do it in this statute?
I think the statutes you're talking about, I think, and I don't have them immediately in front of me to visualize what they're for, But the statutes that talk about notice that I did cite in my brief dealing with certified or registered mail deal with jurisdictional issues. This is strictly a notice statute.
No, I understand the difference in the statutes.
Okay. That's.
But I'm trying to so get you to help us deal with the language.
Since it is only a notice statute and does not confer jurisdiction or anything else on the court, I believe there is a room for statutory interpretation following established Delaware statutory rules, that where the legislature acts to ameliorate, as I use the term, the statute of limitations, it's considered a remedial statute.
I agree with that.
My question is,
when they do that, and they do it with specific language, how do we have respect for our role in the structure of government as someone who interprets the statutes as opposed to legislates? How do we get beyond the language?
I think you look at the purpose of the separate statutes, and unfortunately I don't have those statutes right in front of me, so I'm not exactly sure, so I can only deal with the statutes I have used before. And I think, I hesitate to say this, but I think the reality of the situation, we know how these statutes are drafted pretty much, and that issue probably was never even considered when the statute was passed.
Notwithstanding the fact they use the word by overnight delivery using a nationally recognized carrier in another statute, and they use the language certified mail or its equivalent in another statute, it's reasonable for us to assume they never considered it here.
I think as the reality of the situation, we know when the statutes are drafted, they're not drafted by legislature. Somebody, in fact, we know that this statute was the result of a committee drafting it and giving it to the legislature to pass it. I would think that, you know, someone just didn't envision this situation, because the purpose of certified mail is to guarantee that there is proof of receipt.
Let me focus on that for a moment. As I understand the facts, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, not only was it not sent certified mail, but it was misaddressed, at least as to one of the recipients, the doctor.
There was a...
And there is no proof that the doctor actually received it, whereas with the hospital, I guess there is proof of receipt. So if the purpose of certified mail that you've just explained is to make sure that you can prove that the recipient actually got the notice, we don't even have that accomplished here with respect to the doctor, do we?
If I may correct, Your Honor.
Sure.
With regard to Dr. Greenspun, there is a signed receipt showing it delivered to 501
Which
West.
Is not his address.
Yes, that is. The address on the letter was a typical error or whatever. The address was sent to 500. I admit that. But the Federal Express receipt shows it was delivered to 501 and signed for.
Signed for at 501 by the doctor's office.
By the doctor's office. Or at least we presume. I mean, recall, this is a...
The doctor says he never received it.
Well, that's a problem, Your Honor, because this is on a motion to dismiss. Nowhere in the record, neither written, affidavit, or testified to, other, is there any statement by the doctor saying, I didn't receive this?
Well, then where does that fact come from?
It was just put in by the lawyer in the papers.
Well, did the lawyers for the doctor deny that there was a receipt?
They did in their moving papers, they made that statement. But there's nothing, no statement by the doctor in the record, by affidavit or otherwise. And on a motion to dismiss, I pled in the complaint that they received it. There's been no answer filed by the doctor. So on a motion to dismiss, that fact has to be taken as true.
So your position is it really turns on whether Federal Express satisfies the statutory requirement for certified mail on the motion to dismiss.
Yes.
You agree that it was sent by Federal Express and not certified mail.
Yes, and as I pointed out, I did it reluctantly. I had a reason for doing it. It wasn't just haphazard.
No, I understand. But going back to your point that it's a motion to dismiss,
correct.
The facts we have before us are a statute that calls for certified mail, sending by Federal Express, and we have to assume that it was received for purposes of the motion to dismiss.
No,
so the legal question is, does Federal Express satisfy the statutory requirement?
I would think so, yes, Your Honor. And applying the rules of statutory construction, as I suggested to you,
Mr. Weber, just to pause for a moment and to follow up on Justice Holland's question, suppose the notice were transmitted not by Federal Express but by hand delivery, and assume that the person that hand delivered filed an affidavit setting forth all the facts pertaining to the delivery. Would that satisfy the statute?
I would think that would be factually somewhat different because you didn't have a signed acknowledgement by the recipient that he got it. Here, in the case, we have a signed receipt that he got it. As far as Dr. Greenspan goes, as far as the hospital goes, they admitted it in their answer. They received it.
So if there were hand delivery combined with an signed receipt, would that do it?
I think if you follow my argument, it might possibly do it, but I can see the differentiation.
Why wouldn't it do it? I mean, why wouldn't hand delivery satisfy?
Using Federal Express and certified mail, you have an impartial person not involved with, let's say, my office sending it by hand delivery, delivering it, saying that. And
I suppose you've got an independent delivery service.
Well, that's what Federal Express is, an independent
But suppose
service.
It's a hand delivery service.
But it is. Federal Express, I may be cutting hairs here, Federal Express is more akin to mail than hand delivery services. Although the cases, some of the cases I cited, said where the statute requires registered or certified mail, they said since it's only a notice statute, hand delivery is satisfactory.
The logic of your position is that because the Federal Express satisfied the purpose of the statute, then the literal language of the statute doesn't restrict the form of service or delivery, correct?
Not if you apply the rules of statutory construction as I read them to be in this situation.
I'm not sure what that answer means, but if your logic holds up, then wouldn't it apply to any form of delivery that fulfills the purpose of the statute? That is,
any form of delivery that has a signed receipt evidencing delivery or where the party admits they received it.
All right.
I don't mean to say that I'm beating a dead horse, but I think the statutory rules of construction are clear here. The purpose of the statute is to show proof of receipt. And I realize you have the technical word certified mail, but the cases that I have seen that have interpreted that language dealing with, and when I realized that this had happened, I went back and I was familiar with those cases. Clearly, we're dealing with the delivery of court documents and legal papers, and they said it's jurisdictional, where this is not a jurisdictional. You don't obtain jurisdiction by doing this. You're just telling the doctor, you know, we're putting you on notice of this.
You wanted to save 7 minutes. You can continue, but you're into the time you've reserved.
Yes. I did give myself an extra 2 minutes when I did it. I realized that. The defendants in this case, I just point out, do not dispute that this is a statute that tolls the statute of limitations. They do not dispute that it is remedial, and I don't believe they dispute that if it is remedial, it has to be liberally or expansively interpreted. They're merely saying the basic argument is a statute of construction, statute of limitations has to be strictly construed. That would be applicable if this had happened before this legislature spoke and said, we want to soften the effect of the statute of limitations. And I think that's a major distinction. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Dollar.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Bill Durler, and I represent Defendant Greenspan in this matter. I'll be splitting the time with Ms. Quinlan. She'll be taking the last 5 minutes. In this case, the plaintiff contends that there's a narrow issue whether the notice sent via Federal Express provides the notice required by the statute. That issue, in our view, is entirely too narrow because the notice itself did not comply in virtually any way with the statute.
Let's take them one at a time.
Okay.
Why shouldn't Federal Express be a substitute for certified mail. You've got the same idea. Somebody hands it to you, you sign for it, and you know what's going on.
Your Honor, first of all, I think that takes the leap to the fact that we have to somehow interpret this to include Federal Express. As you said earlier, this is a matter of statutory construction.
And well, that was a question. That was a question.
Okay. It is not a matter of statutory construction in this case because the statute is very clear. It's plain on its face. There's no reasonable interpretation of the term certified mail to mean anything other than United States certified mail.
So can't you look at this from the standpoint of substantial compliance, that yes, this is different than what the statute calls for? It's very hard to say it isn't. It wasn't certified mail, and the statute says certified mail. So we've got a difference right from the get-go. But then the question, it seems, becomes, well, how significant is it that a different method was used than what was required in the statute? Why doesn't the concept of substantial compliance, given the purpose that I think everyone agrees of certified mail was to make sure that it is received and that there's proof of the receipt. So if you accomplish that through another recognized method, or even through a method that, as Justice Jacobs was suggesting, a method that isn't very similar, such as having hand delivery by a courier service, if you've satisfied the essential components of getting it to the person and having a signed acknowledgement that you got this document to this person, why shouldn't that be enough to say that you've satisfied the statute?
First of all, I don't think a substantial compliance analysis is appropriate in the context of this statute of limitations provision. This is a substantive right granted to the plaintiff to extend the statute of limitations. In that situation, this is a special statute of limitations with a built-in time frame. The requirements must be strictly construed. Therefore,
okay, why must they be strictly construed?
Because it is a jurisdictional statute of limitations, Your Honor. When it's built in and grant and you get this, there's a special statute. This is not in Title 10. This isn't a medical malpractice statute of limitations. It's actually a tolling provision,
right,
creating the right to toll, giving that right to the plaintiff, provided that they take affirmative steps, very simple affirmative steps, clear and concise, to extend, to enable get the right to do that. In addition, another reason the substantial compliance analysis is not appropriate in this particular case is that the statute itself requires proof of compliance in the complaint by attaching these letters. So basically, the legislature is sending a message that we don't want to have litigation over the issue of whether this has been received. All we want you to do is do this very simple thing, attach the letter, a proper notice, to the complaint, proving that you've complied. And so, the intent of the statute is to avoid litigation. The intent of this statute was not simply to provide notice to the defendant.
Well, let me see if I have your point. Your major point is that this is a jurisdictional requirement, and I gather, and tell me if I'm wrong, by that you mean that the right to sue, that is, that in the jurisdiction of the court to hear the suit, depends on the complaint being filed within 2 years. And if not, there can be no waiver of that statutory requirement. Is that correct?
Your Honor, the 90 days...
Forget the 90 days.
Okay.
And I thought the 90 days just extends the statute.
Correct.
But the statute itself, at least I understood you to say, is jurisdictional. Do you mean by that if the malpractice action is filed beyond 2 years, or even beyond 2 years and 90 days, there can be no right of action, even if the defendant is willing to waive the statute?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I believe that the way that it has been interpreted, it has been a very harsh, interpreted as being a very harsh result. That's why the saving statute.
Is that what you mean by jurisdictional?
Yes.
That is, the limitations condition cannot be waived.
Correct.
All right.
All right. Well, Mr. Doyler, let's go to the two statutes I asked Mr. Aber about. One provides for overnight delivery by nationally recognized carrier or certified mail. And the other statute says certified mail or its equivalent. Following up on Justice Berger's question, why doesn't that evidence a legislative intent that certified mail means getting the notice to the person and that there are other ways to do it? And these two other statutes seem to evidence a legislative acknowledgement that a nationally recognized carrier is the equivalent of certified mail. And when they use the word equivalent in the other statute, it says there may be other equivalents. So why should we focus exclusively on certified mail when there are other Delaware statutes that recognize other means are equivalent to certified mail?
For the simple fact, Your Honor, that they put it in the other statutes and did not put it in this one. The clear intent, by putting it in those statutes and eliminating it from this, means that they want they want this served by certified mail. Mr. Aber suggested that the others, that somehow the difference is that these other statutes weren't somehow or weren't simply notice provisions that were some, but in fact these statutes that you cited were simply to provide notice. So the fact that it wasn't serving a court paper is not really the issue. The fact is that the legislature, when they want to allow for alternative service, has said that alternative service is permissible. If you allow for alternative service in this context, you're going to get into needless litigation about whether there's been actual receipt, whether the type of service at issue has been is equivalent, complies with the statute. This is all needless litigation in the context of a statute of limitations and a tolling provision, both of which were designed to reduce litigation associated with medical malpractice effort to reduce premiums.
You're saying then that one of the conditions to having the right to sue is to submit with the complaint irrefutable proof that there was notice given to and received by the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor. And the last line of subsection 3 of that statute provides that a copy of the notice shall be attached to the complaint to prove compliance with the statute of limitations. So what they say, another precondition to invoking this right is that you have to establish in the complaint that you have complied. Otherwise, you have not earned the right to extend the statute of limitations an additional 90 days.
I'd like to get back to your point about avoiding additional litigation. If I understood, you were saying that the reason why we should stick with the certified mail and nothing else, including no equivalent method of delivery, is because with the certified mail, all you have to do is prove that you did it by certified mail and that somebody signed for it. And then the defendant doesn't get to argue, well, I didn't actually receive it, or, you know, this person who signed for it wasn't authorized to sign for it, or anything like that, because you have complied with the statute, and that's that. Is that correct?
I think in order to toll the statute of limitations, you must comply with the statute. Again, it's only a 90-day extension, you know, so I don't...
Right, but forget the amount of time. What I'm concerned with the logistics, if you will. When somebody does it correctly, or as you would have us hold, they have to send this notice by certified mail, return receipt requested. And that gets delivered, and somebody in the doctor's office signs that piece of paper, and it goes back to the plaintiff. Right?
Yes.
But it's not the doctor himself who signs that receipt. It's somebody in his office, right?
Correct.
Okay. And if I understand you, you're saying that under the current arrangement, if the statute is followed strictly, that all the plaintiff would have to do is say, here's my proof that I served, I used certified mail, and here's the little form that has the signature on it, and the doctor couldn't come in and say, well, you may have done all that, but I never got it because this person doesn't even work in my office anymore. I don't know who it was who signed for it, but, you know, it's not me. I never got it, and so on and so forth. There would, in other words, there would be no possibility of any factual dispute about whether there was actual notice given or not because you've complied with what the statute says is required.
I believe as long as it's correctly addressed, I think there can be, still be a dispute about whether, as there is in this case, whether it's correctly addressed. But if you address it to the doctor's office and it's signed for, I believe that that is part of the intent of the legislature, is to allow this to go forward because you have done what the statute requires.
Okay, and the doctor, even if the doctor did not ever see this and it never actually got to him, that would be sufficient, and the doctor couldn't make that argument, that factual argument,
right? I believe that that is a fair reading of the statute, Your Honor.
Okay. Wouldn't we be accomplishing the same result if the interpretation of the statute were along the lines of you do it by certified mail and you're safe? You do it by some other method that is the equivalent of certified mail, and if there's an issue as to whether there was actual notice or not, then you lose because the statute says do it by certified mail, and we're not going to have additional litigation over whether the doctor received it and who signed for it and so on and so forth. Why wouldn't that accomplish what this statute is all about?
I'm not sure I follow Your Honor's question. The intent of the statute is to allow the plaintiff additional time to investigate,
right,
and to eliminate frivolous claims.
Right.
The notice provision is a secondary portion of that. That's not the main focus of this statute. The main focus of this statute is to allow the plaintiff to toll the statute of limitations if it does very ministerial things. The equivalent result question, I think you're inviting litigation as to what the equivalence is, which is, again, what the statute is trying to avoid. Is Federal Express enough? Is UPS enough? Is hand delivery enough? So I think that if you're I don't think that you would want to engage in an analysis of equivalence. Did that answer your question?
Thank you.
With respect to the remaining reasons why this particular notice didn't comply with the statute of is that I just want to briefly touch on the fact.
Did the trial court reach those other issues?
I don't believe it did. I believe it found that just that was
the failure to use certified mail was controlling.
Correct.
So
I believe that the issue, however, was before the court. The arguments were raised that the other defendants were not listed in the notice, which is a requirement. It was not addressed to the regular place of business. That obviously was before the court. There's no dispute at this point that 500 was not the correct address. In addition, and you get into the description, it had the wrong year. The description, in this case, the description of the event was actually a date in the future. So there's clearly some confusion and it was not an unambiguous notice of what the issue was. So for all of those reasons, even if you get to a substantial compliance analysis, this particular notice to Dr. Greenspun did not substantially comply. So for these reasons, I request that you affirm the decision of Judge Tolliver.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Quinlan.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Amy Quinlan on behalf of Christiana Hospital. You've heard plenty of argument. This has come up a second time before the Court. But I did want to touch on a couple of issues that I don't think have been completely fleshed out. Specifically, I believe that the issue of substantial compliance has been, in fact, waived by the plaintiff in their brief on page 12, where he describes the argument as being a strongman argument. Instead, plaintiff would ask us to look at the statute and say that it needs to be broadly interpreted, and I don't think you get there. I think that our rules of construction say that if a statute is clear on its face, that you don't even get to the construction point. So whether it's broadly or narrowly construed is not a question that this court would be faced with given the clear terms of that particular statute. Secondly, I'd like to point out that the synopsis that accompanied the adoption of this particular provision spoke to the issue as to why this is not just merely a notice statute, and the fact that the legislature, in adopting the statute, clearly contemplated the limiting effect that it would have. And it reads as follows. Additionally, a process to allow up to 90 days to investigate a potential negligence claim is added and would extend the medical malpractice statute of limitations accordingly. And this is the important section. It is expected that this grace period will give plaintiffs an opportunity to determine whether a potential claim has merit and will result in some lawsuits that might otherwise be filed not being filed. I think that the legislature there is clearly contemplating that cases will not be filed based on this additional period, allowing the plaintiff to do investigation. And I think that's important when we think about the historical context of this statute. This was developed originally in 1976 in the face of a crisis with our healthcare system. Prevalence of unmeritorious claims being filed with the court. There was a definite attempt by the legislature to address that. And the point is, plaintiff, come to the court, bring more meritorious claims, have looked at the statute, have read it, and do what you need to do in order to bring it. And that's not an atypical requirement by the legislature. Certainly in 3104 and in the corporate context, there are things that a plaintiff must do affirmatively before the doors of the courtroom are open to them. So I don't think that this is so atypical as to create any kind of harshness to the plaintiff. This was a simple statute. All the plaintiff had to do was open up the book and read it. It said certified mail. There were specific requirements that needed to be addressed. They weren't. And therefore, the plaintiff's claim is extinguished.
If everything were as simple as that, I guess we wouldn't be here.
I think that you're probably right, Your Honor. I know that we have a little bit of a different situation, and I don't know if the court has any questions with regard to that. We did not, in our answer, contest that we received notice of the papers, that we did not receive the papers themselves. We admitted that we did, in fact, receive them. At some point, we don't know when, and, in fact, my client really can't tell when it came to the door. But all that being said, it's not really what's at issue here because the statute is not solely about notice, but upon the affirmative duty of the plaintiff to have followed the terms of the statute. So it's the sending of it as opposed to the receipt that's most important here.
Could you give us the page number of the that portion of the brief?
Certainly, Your Honor. It is in the reply brief, page 12, footnote 7.
Well, if the legislature has recognized that there are equivalent methods of delivery for certified mail, why shouldn't we take that into consideration?
The legislature has considered that there are equivalent methods, but did not choose to include those or any reference to equivalent methods in this statute. It instead placed an affirmative duty on the plaintiff to send this by certified mail. I think that that points out that the legislature is clearly aware that there are other methods of service and chose not to include it in that statute as recently as 2003.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I had a chance, Your Honor, with Justice Holland's question, to think about the statutes. And if they're ones that are referred to in that footnote, I think that those statutes are distinguishable, as I point out in that footnote, because neither of those statutes are intended to remediate or be remedial as to any other provision. But this statute, Section 3 of 6856, is inserted to lessen the impact or soften the impact of the statute of limitations, which this Court has said has to be, is rather harsh.
Well, in that same footnote, it certainly appears that you are abjuring any suggestion that you're arguing substantial compliance.
No, I was not addressing there the issues of the 500 versus 501. I don't think. I'd have to go back and read the brief.
No, I'm okay. Talking about abjuring any suggestion that you're that a substantial analysis, substantial compliance analysis is being advanced here. That you're not relying on the doctrine of substantial compliance as a tool. As a tool to construe the statute.
It may be a matter of terminology, and I can see maybe it could be substantial compliance. But I think what I'm really pointing out to is that this is a remedial statute, and it has to be viewed accordingly. Two things I would like to point out. One is that the defendant stated that this is a jurisdictional statute, which cannot be waived. But a statute of limitations is a waivable defense. If it's not pled according to Rule 8, it's waived.
Isn't the statute whatever the legislature says it is?
Well, I would think because Christiane, in this case, moved to amend their answer to add this because they hadn't done it in the first place. And I think a statute of limitations is clearly an affirmative defense under Rule 8 of the Superior Court. So it is a waivable defense if they don't assert it. And if they can waive it, then it's not jurisdictional.
Are you saying the rule of procedure can trump a legislative enactment?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. But all statute of limitations are legislative acts. The standard 2-year statute of limitation for any personal injury is a legislative act. And that's viewed as an affirmative defense. And if it's affirmative defense, it can be waived. Then it's not jurisdictional, I think. The last point I do want to make, and I suggest this with all due respect to the court, and maybe because I haven't given it as firm a thought I would think, but the fact that you have a statute which does say certified mail and other means in an unrelated statute, I don't believe there's a rule of statutory construction. I do not understand the rule of statutory construction where you say where statutes are in, they have to be reconciled when they're in pari materia with each other. But when you have statutes completely unrelated, I don't believe you can use unrelated statutes to interpret a statute when there are established rules of construction for interpreting the statute at issue. I'm not sure if I make that clear. But I think there are established rules for interpreting the statute, given its purpose.
Well, I understand what you said, even if you don't. Tell us how we get beyond the plain language, and you seem to suggest that even though it says certified mail, because of the nature of this statute, we have freedom to conclude the legislature didn't mean certified mail.
That is the interpretation that this court has used on statutes that provide notice, like long-arm service, providing appeal bonds, where it's jurisdictional. This is not, I go back to saying this is not a jurisdictional statute. This is a notice statute, and I think there you can argue, as courts throughout the country have interpreted this, that the idea is, has the notice been provided? And at this stage of litigation, it has to be presumed it was provided.
Well, and as Justice Jacobs pointed out, it seems you have at least two choices. You don't have to pick one, but maybe the alternative. One is substantial compliance with the plain language or compliance through equivalent of service.
I'm not sure. If by substantial compliance you mean it's certified mail and nothing else. That's one interpretation.
No, we all know that you didn't give certified mail.
I know that.
So the question is, does Federal Express constitute substantial compliance with the certified mail requirement, or is Federal Express the functional equivalent of certified mail?
I'm not comfortable with responding because I'm not sure what you mean by substantial compliance. That has a technical meaning that I might be walking into, but I think it has clearly Federal Express has the functional equivalent of certified mail.
Well, if there is a time to walk into something, Mr. Apert, this is it.
All right. I'm not... I would say it is substantial compliance in a non-technical sense. I'm not sure, and I've not thought about it yet, whether it's substantial compliance that we're using in any technical legal term here that I I just can't commit because I'm not sure.
We'll figure it out.
What?
We'll figure it out.
I apologize, Your Honor, for waffling on that, but I'm just not sure.
Thank you very much. The court appreciates all of your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement and take a brief recess.